I start this sermon with a question I know the answer to. Have any of us ever prayed fervently into the darkness and heard absolutely nothing but silence in return? I know that we have. Probably some of us have experienced this today, this weekend. Have you ever been left pining without an answer, when you felt like you needed it most? Have you ever wondered why God is silent when everyone else seems so full of opinions? This silence, this astonishing silence in the face of problems great and small, is overwhelming at times. It can drive free thinkers like us into renunciation, to declaring that any force which would answer our pain with only silence is not only non-existent, but a distraction. And yet, for some of us, even when we have no answers, or even when the answers we do get are way more complicated than we had hoped for, even then, our hearts reach out to that which is greater than ourselves. Reach out to that which is greater than ourselves, if not to fix it all, then at least to bear silent, holy witness to the actual gritty truths of our existence. As a clergywoman and pastor, Barbara Brown Taylor encounters the aftermath of God's silence all the time. And in her marvelous little book, When God is Silent, she says, "Very few people come to me because they want to discuss something God said to them last night. The large majority come to me because they cannot get God to say anything at all. They have asked as sincerely as they know how for answers, for peace, but they are still missing those things. They want me to tell them what they have done wrong. Perhaps I know a special technique they can try, or better yet, perhaps I can lend my own weight to the cause, adding the poundage of my prayers to theirs in an effort to force some sound from God's silent lips. Their wish to hear God speak is not unfounded. The Bible they read portrays a God who not only speaks, but also acts. Right there on the page, the faithful receive what they ask for: children, manna, land, health. By implication, those who ask and do not receive are not faithful. This is the condemnation that hangs over God's silence. Like Barbara Brown Taylor, like all of those who witness the aftermath of God's silence, we know for a fact that this condemnation of the silence is untrue. If anybody at all could say the right things or do the right things or do the right kind of trick that would get God to finally talk, if anyone could do it and get real answers out of God in return, it would be a great many of you. People we have memorialized in this sanctuary. People whom we have lost who prayed and lived and died, all with some central yearning that went utterly unanswered until the very end. People who never did make it big, never did see their children through the darkness, never did make amends to those they lost or find the one they loved out of all the earth's multitudes. I could give a list a mile long of those who lived their lives as models of patience and who were met with God's silence or God's absence or God's distance when they thought they needed her most. And almost all of those people, this is the wonder of it, almost all of them, those we have loved and lost right here among us, went finally to their deaths, not angry at the silence, but quiet in its presence. Content in all they did not know and did not get and did not hear from the source of all things to whom they bent a silent knee on dark nights. The very best of us get ambiguity when we crave answers. The bravest among us get non-words when all we want is the prayer that will fix it all. The holiest ones so often get silence, a void, a space between the words. And who are we to say it is not enough? Who are we to say that it is not the core of wisdom itself, that God's silence is not truer than all of our words? Especially those who, like myself, specialize in the constant production of words. Words meant to throw against the darkness in the hope that one or two of them might stick long enough to create some actual illumination. Each summer, as some of you know, I am lucky enough to take a period of time for most of July and the first week of August for study and vacation as I gear up for what I think of as the church year. You know, September hits and all of a sudden brew is a freight train rolling ahead full speed, never to be stopped. And so in early August, as I start to gear up for that, I found myself a few years ago at the tail end of my time away completely unprepared to stand up here and talk to you all for 20 minutes every Sunday again. This happens every so often. Not just to me, but to most people who write and speak and weave words, I begin to wonder if all of the words generated in the service of truth are just that, words. Shallow reflections of actual truth tossed together in an inherently futile effort to speak something wiser than the silence itself. Again, to paraphrase Barbara Brown Taylor, I wonder if what we speak about in church is the cartoon version of real life. When the actual lived experience of this thing is so much deeper than any of our words could ever convey. Now, before any of you, because you are kind, go worrying about me and feel compelled out of care to ease my doubts and tell me that my work is not inherently meaningless and that some words do matter, let me say, I don't share this in order to generate assurances. I tell you this because I think it's important for people, including each and every one of us, to call ourselves to task on our own idolatry. Our own idolatry, those things that we raise to higher levels than that which is holy, those things that we put undue faith in to the detriment of truth. And I think I am not alone in saying that one of my great idolatries in this world is my deep affection for words. I love Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Not because of the plot or even the message, both of which are probably racist, but because that man so masterfully turns a phrase. I choose sermon topics not because I know for a fact I have something to say about it, but because one line or quote digs into my head and won't let go. I literally cast off novels after one page if the prose is clumsy. And I believe, really believe, sometimes to my great spiritual detriment, that if we can just find the words for things, we can likewise find the truth of them too. And if I pray out loud with a great many of you, which I do, it's not because I think God can hear, but because we can hear. And saying the words in the company of people I love is often the closest thing I can find to saving grace. And yet, an idolater must name her idolatry. And the fact remains that for all my love of a well-crafted phrase, a word is still a word, and truth is still something else, in differing degrees removed from all the symbols and words and songs and stories and concepts we try to wrap around it and contain it with. The word, no matter how much I love it, is not the thing. For Christians out there, Jesus is often beautifully characterized as the Logos, the Word made flesh. There's a great lot of power to that idea, and I will not try to do a thorough examination of it here, because that would just be disastrous. But to put it as briefly as possible, the concept is like this. God spoke, and bone and flesh and skin wrapped around her words and turned into this being who walked among the people, the Word made flesh, the language of God given a human form to walk around. But for us, for religious people who believe in some truth that transcends even the person of Jesus himself, it is the source of the Word, not the Word itself, that is the ultimate aim of all devotion. It is the power from which all language emanates that is the object of prayer, not the language itself that we use to describe the mystery. It is the source of the Word, not the Word itself, that counts. And confusing our words, our concepts, our ideas, our pictures with the source of them, confusing the concrete symbol with the infinite mystery, that's putting something else in the place of God. And in general, spiritually speaking, that is just not good form. Spirituality is about a great many things. It's about what gives us comfort in the night and what gets us through the day and guides our moral choices. It's also about never giving up the good work of becoming deeper, truer, and more accountable to all that is holy. That's my fancy way of saying that spirituality should challenge us on our crap and help us to be better people. So that August, a few years ago, sick of words, and yet utterly, idolatrously enraptured by them, I booked myself a 2-day silent retreat. It was a sort of dorky, self-imposed spiritual improvement boot camp. And I went to this marvelous place called Day Spring in Maryland. And if any of you need a safe and wonderful and nurturing place to go call yourself on your own crap for a couple of days, I would be happy to share a referral. At this program that I designed for myself, there was, in fact, no plan, there was no form, there was no stuff, there was no doing. There were just a couple of days, and in fact, no other people to interact with, except a friendly young man who greeted me at the door and reminded me that should I encounter other guests, I should preempt their asking of questions with some sort of prayerful gesture that indicated I was not going to talk back. 2 days of silence before an onslaught of words, 2 days in which my only task was to not inspire anyone with my eloquence. And much of the time, I just walked around. And much of the time, I indulged in my idolatrous love of words by reading other people's sermons. But some of the time, I was actually quiet. And in that quiet place, I let myself ask the God of my own understanding if she had anything to tell me. And all I got in return, from God or from my own psyche, hardly matters to me, was the message, "Be quiet, child. Be quiet." Nothing fancy. No big convictions, not even much inspiration, honestly. And when you think about it, it's a pretty shoddy and oversimplified lesson to learn at a silent retreat, isn't it? Be quiet, child. Be quiet. Seems kind of trite, except that, compared to the great mystery of God's silence, all of my words really are the babblings of a toddler. Except that most human beings, including myself, only remember about 25% of what they have heard over the course of several days. So apparently none of us are very good listeners to start with. Except that something like 40% of our garbage is paper printed with an almost endless series of words we have apparently either ignored or absorbed and decided we're quite done with. Be quiet, child. Be quiet. Might be the best advice I ever got. For it just may be that the truest voice of the divine is no voice at all. The most honest answer to our prayers may be the exact opposite of the swirling mass of language we swim through every day. It might be the persistent non-answer that comes in the dark of the night when all you want is the capital T truth laid out before you in a manner that is easy to understand. It might be that silence is the deepest thing we'll ever know. Be quiet, child, be quiet. And you never know what non-answers you'll hear. Be quiet, child, be quiet, and in return for all of your questing, the Almighty might offer a glorious and beautiful void in the place where all your words used to be. Silence comes hand in hand with ambiguity, with the power of moving from having the answers, or at least faking it as if we do, to a place when the answers twist themselves into non-answers and clarity becomes just another version of confusion. The spiritual challenge in these times is to lean into the ambiguity, not to try all over again to contain it and get it under control, but to let it be and live in the not knowing long enough that we let go of the illusion we ever had it all figured out in the first place. The categorization of life, the nailing it down, the getting it right, is sometimes the greatest idolatry of all, an idolatry of our own intellect, the assumption that we could ever fully understand the mystery. But faith has a way of moving us from clarity to ambiguity, from answers to non-answers, from words to silence. As French philosopher Max Picard has said, silence is the central place of faith, where we give the word back to God from whom we first received it. And once we've given back all of our words, all of our definitions, all of our surety, we're left with a great deal of ambiguity. And as you all know, ambiguity is not the favorite condition of the human brain. We are categorizing creatures. It is in our nature to try and figure things out, and living with ambiguity is not an easy thing to do at all. But as some have reminded me, living with ambiguity is a sign of spiritual maturity. The ability to cope with not knowing is a sign that we are ready to grow. It may not feel good, it may not be fun, but at least it's not a lie. And most of the time, it's closer to the truth than any doctrine or platitude or diagnosis we could offer. The task of life, first and foremost, is to live it, not to name it. To be in it as it is, without answers, without concepts, without words. The job of each of us, first and foremost, is to live alongside one another, not to diagnose each other. Not even to inspire each other, but to live alongside one another, present in the mystery which will not be nailed down no matter how hard we try. In the words of poet Janet Morley, "And you held me, and there were no words, and there was no time, and you held me, and there was only wanting, and being held, and being filled with wanting, and I was nothing but letting go, and being held, and there were no words, and there needed to be no words, and there was no terror, but only stillness, and I was wanting nothing, and it was fullness, and it was like aching for God. And it was tough and warmth and darkness and no time and no words, and we flowed and I was empty and I was given up to the dark, and in the darkness I was not lost. And the waiting was like fullness, and I could hardly hold it, and I was held. And you were dark and warm and without time and without words, and you held me." In many of the legends and stories ascribed to the Buddha, he is referred to as Sayamuni, which might be translated roughly as one who is gracefully silent. The one who, given half a chance, will say absolutely nothing at all. Buddhist tradition holds that when people were presumptuous enough to ask the Buddha to explain the truth with a capital T, at every available opportunity, he answered with silence. It was the perfect antidote, the perfect answer. His silence, like that of God, was enough for those who truly sought enlightenment. When you pray and you hear nothing, pay attention to the sound of nothing. Not to the absence of words, but to the presence of mystery. not the absence of absolutes, but the presence of the unknown. And in that deep and abiding presence, may there be freedom and gentleness and laughter and peace. Be quiet, child. Be quiet. And oh, what wonders you might hear.